There's no solution without using permanent fund earnings. And although it's hard to say, there's no solution without adjusting the dividend calculation as well.
The tough job of balancing the state budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 21st. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a tanker fire briefly shuts down the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
We evacuated the area and immediately shut down the pipeline.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A 36-year-old inmate has been found dead at the Anchorage Correctional Complex. Department of Corrections officials say in a release that Brian Pinkerton was found dead just before 7 a.m. today. He had a full medical exam on Wednesday that didn't indicate anything was wrong. An autopsy will be conducted, but officials say preliminary reports didn't show any signs of physical trauma. The release says he had spent time in a specialized medical unit, but was allowed to return to the prison's general population. Pinkerton has been in jail since January 8th on multiple probation violations. He is the fourth inmate to die in custody this year. All prisoner deaths are reviewed by Alaska State Troopers and the State Medical Examiner's Office. The Corrections Department will also conduct an internal review. Lawmakers are considering some of the most wide-ranging changes in the history of Alaska finances this year. That's why the leaders of the House Finance Committee invited Governor Bill Walker and top state officials to talk about their budget plan, especially the latest proposal to draw from permanent fund earnings. Revenue Commissioner Randall Hoffbeck says with oil prices low for the foreseeable future, the only way to sustain the state budget is by drawing on the wealth the state has built up in the permanent fund. While Walker's budget plan includes new taxes and cuts to oil and gas tax credits, its centerpiece is the permanent fund plan.
The other pieces of the plan will provide millions of dollars to the solution, but the permanent fund earnings can sustainably contribute billions of dollars to the solution. And it is the only lever large enough that can get us to a sustainable solution. There's no solution without using permanent fund earnings. And although it's hard to say, there's no solution without adjusting the dividend calculation as well.
It's not clear if the Wednesday presentation changed any minds. About half of the legislature skipped it. And those who did attend repeated points they've made throughout the three-month session. Walker says it's important to have every element of his plan, including introducing a broad-based tax like an income tax. Eagle River Republican Representative Dan Sadler asked Walker if he'd veto the permanent fund bill based on spending a percent of the fund's market value, or POMV, if the legislature didn't pass new taxes.
You were able to get this, but not the income tax, not the consumption taxes, not the resource taxes, not the tax credits. Would you let this piece go by, or would you insist on having the whole thing and veto the POMV?
Walker suggested he'd sign it.
All that those would certainly go through that that come into play. There's no question about that. I'm not going to not let something go through that gets done. My goal is to make sure they all get through, but I'm not going to stop something going through because not everything is in line exactly.
Even when state officials feel they've made the case for their plan, they find it's difficult to win over Alaskans skeptical of a plan that could lead to a 50% cut in permanent fund dividends. Hoffbeck recalled his experience talking about a similar plan last year in Fairbanks.
Well, we thought we'd done pretty well on the weekend. We'd elevated the discussion. People were starting to talk about the issues. They started to understand the problem. The next day, I get into a cab on my way out of town. And the cabbie, when I get in the cab, he's got news talk radio playing. And on the radio, it's me talking about taxes. This cabbie has no idea who I am. And he does one of these. He goes, "That guy's an idiot."
Today is the 94th day of the legislative session. It's not clear when or if the legislature will vote on the permanent fund bill. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline is back in operation following a tank fire that shut it down for 9 hours yesterday. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company spokeswoman Michelle Egan says workers saw flames coming from a large crude oil storage tank at Pump Station 5 near the base of Attigan Pass in the Brooks Range about 2:20 yesterday afternoon.
And they called in the incident to our operations control center. We evacuated the area and immediately shut down the pipeline.
Egan says firefighters went in last night and extinguished the flames. She says no oil was spilled and the tank was taken offline. The 800-mile pipeline restarted at a reduced flow rate at 11:30 p.m. Egan says operators have to be cautious ramping up throughput because Pump Station 5 provides pressure relief.
Because we have the tank out of service, we want to be operating at a lower flow rate until we can get crews on site at each of the remote gate valves as a precaution in case we need to close valves because we don't have that pressure relief tank available to us.
Egan says oil flow will be gradually increased today. She says it's unclear what caused the tank fire, but a team has been assembled to investigate the incident. Oil development is ramping up in the National Petroleum Reserve. ConocoPhillips Alaska says it's adding wells and other infrastructure at its CD5 site in the Alpine Field. The site is the first commercial oil development on Alaska Native lands within the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. It began producing oil in October. The CD5 pad was designed for 33 wells. Original development funding was for 15 wells and 10 have been completed. ConocoPhillips estimates the cost of the new project at approximately $190 million and says the additional wells and infrastructure will bring the site to its full design and permit capacity. Project work will begin this year. The first oil from the next phase of drilling is expected in the third quarter of 2017. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the important but stressful job of a village health aide.
I went to go check again and it was like thick ice fog. And he said, well, you're going to have to do a chest tube. Okay.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
A village public safety officer from Emonic was arrested yesterday for pointing a firearm at three residents of the community. Alaska State Troopers say they responded last Friday. Their investigation led to the arrest of 68-year-old J. Leroy Levan. Levan was arrested in Anchorage yesterday and charged with three counts of third-degree assault and one count of official misconduct. Foster care in Alaska is the state's last resort for helping kids who have been abused or neglected, and the number of kids in the system is at a record high. Nearly 3,000 children are in out-of-home care. One foster care worker says part of the solution is in prevention, helping families before maltreatment starts. A new program in Anchorage and the Matsu Valley is doing just that. Alaska Public Media's urban affairs reporter Ann Hillman learned about Safe Families for Children for the fourth piece in our series, Fostering Our Future.
Last fall, Anna Maria Balcazar learned she needed to have a mass removed from her ovary. After the surgery, she wouldn't be able to lift anything for 6 weeks, including her 2-year-old daughter.
I talked to the doctor and said, look, I don't think so. Can we wait maybe 6 more months, 1 more year? And she said, no, absolutely no. We have to do it now. It's very dangerous.
But Balcazar didn't have anyone to take care of her 2 young daughters. Her family is in Peru, and her friends couldn't help.
You know, the few friends I have, they are in my same situation. They are single mothers with 2-3 kids, and they don't have nobody who helped them. So working, go back to pick up the kids, and then take care of the kids, and then running, go to sleep.
Balcazar was desperate. She asked people at her daughter's school, fellow church members she hardly knew. She even considered calling the Office of Children's Services. Then her pastor told her there was a new program in town that might be able to help. Safe Families for Children, operated by Beacon Hill.
The way that it works is very much centered on kind of just old school hospitality and people taking care of their neighbors.
That's Charity Carmody, who coordinates the Anchorage branch of the international organization. Here's how it works. Families volunteer to take in children for a short period of time while parents work through a crisis, like homelessness or hospitalizations. The program started in Chicago in 2003 and has since spread around the U.S., Canada, the United Kingdom, and Kenya. Carmody says the faith-based program helps families before a crisis leads to child abuse or neglect.
Most child maltreatment happens as a result of social isolation. Parents simply don't have anybody to call in the time of crisis. So we're just trying to create an outlet that they know is safe. We're just trying to give them the ability to make the call themselves before something happens and maybe they put their child in a harmful situation.
Ben Himmela and his wife heard about the program through their church and decided to apply to be a host family. It took months to get background checks, home visits, and final approval. Himmela says the program seemed logical.
If we had friends across the street or neighbors or somebody from church that needed help, we would watch their kids for them. So why wouldn't we just help someone in our community because we're a part of the community? And if they're in need, obviously we want to be able to help out.
The couple took in Anna Balcazar's two children for part of the 6 weeks. They don't have kids of their own yet, and they say it was just as valuable a learning experience for them as it was a way to give back. Himmela says he thought he was so on top of things one morning. He had the toddler in the car and was off to work on time. Then he reached into his briefcase and pulled out a squishy, dirty diaper instead of his thermos of coffee.
Yeah, pride comes before the fall, right? And so it's just that respect for what parents go through each and every day. And you don't think about that until you have kids of your own or you're able to be around that.
The Himmela say taking in the girls wasn't a burden. A network of people from Safe Families and their church donated diapers, toys, and dinners and helped pick up the kids from school. And all of the host families made sure the girls talked to their mom almost every day. Balcazar says she needed that.
They know my heart was broken because I don't have them. And they tried to heal at the same time my heart, you know, like make me call them and see them by FaceTime.
After 6 long weeks apart, Balcazar is reveling in having her kids back. She shows off her older daughter's school binder full of completed homework and translates one of her younger daughter's favorite books from Spanish to English.
And she loves it because I have to say, Froggy, say mama. What? Say Froggy. Come and brush your teeth.
Balcazar says her kids came home spouting instructions from their host families on behavior and parenting techniques, and she loved it.
They were coming and teach me, say, Mom, Lauren told me I have to do this like that and brush my teeth like this and do this like that. And I like, wow, that's good. So you're learning more stuff. You have to teach me. Yes, at nighttime you have to read me a book. 30 minutes.
The program was a lifeline and a lesson for Balcazar. And she says she's ready to give back as soon as she can. Safe Families for Children currently offers help for families in Anchorage and in the Matsu Valley, though they hope to expand the program statewide. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
University of Alaska Fairbanks researchers will play a big role in 3 newly funded climate change and wildfire studies. Alaska Fire Science Consortium ecologist Randy Jant says teams that include UAF-based and trained researchers will focus on implications of increasing warmth and fire activity from a cross-disciplinary perspective.
It's often difficult to join up the world of research and academia with the world of actual on-the-ground fire management.
One of the nationally funded research projects will employ computer modeling to better anticipate and address peak fire activity.
When we get those really big years, like, you know, last year was a good example, it really strains the limits of available resources for fire management.
Another focuses on improving fire weather forecasting, and the third will consider broad-ranging impacts of more tundra fires on the North Slope.
Such as permafrost thaw, which could affect infrastructure and plant succession and therefore habitat for wildlife. And then there's the whole carbon question.
Funding for the studies comes from nearly $1 million in grants from the National Joint Fire Science Program and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. As corrosion rapidly degrades the Port of Anchorage, its financial future is in the hands of Juneau lawmakers. Funding for construction of port infrastructure was the only request of Anchorage's mayor this session. But as Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, the possibility of legislators taking any action on the project is unlikely.
Trying to follow a large spending proposal in this lean fiscal climate is kind of like a scene from the last Harry Potter book, where Pius Thicknesse is interrogated by Lord Voldemort.
One hears many things, my lord. Whether the truth is among them is not clear.
Spoken like a true politician.
Rumors have swirled for months about whether funding to upgrade essential pieces of the port would come out of this session. Mayor Ethan Berkowitz has requested that a general obligation bond for $290 million go before voters on the November ballot.
It would be like someone's mortgage. It's not all due at one fell swoop. There's a payment that you make over time.
In that scenario, Alaskans would be the ones to decide whether it's worth spending more money on a port that handles the lion's share of cargo, fuel, and construction material coming into the state. To which many residents might say, wait, didn't we already do that? Well, yes, but sort of. More than $300 million of state and federal money were spent on what was called the Port Expansion Project, a botched effort to build more docks that could accommodate more cargo. That project was halted by then-Mayor Dan Sullivan in 2010. But Berkowitz says its reputation lingers.
It just didn't work. I mean, nothing worked about it, except spending people's money. And there's a consequence to that.
The municipality of Anchorage is trying to recover a portion of that money through a lawsuit alleging faulty design and engineering work by subcontracted companies. But the administration and private firm managing the current project insist that the difference between a port expansion and a port modernization goes way beyond semantics. But that argument hasn't gained any traction in the Capitol.
Everybody understands how that's a priority, but at the same time, we don't have any money.
Fairbanks Republican Steve Thompson co-chairs the House's Finance Committee. He hasn't seen any movement on a House bill to bring up the port bond. And he says that even if it went before his constituents on the ballot, they probably don't have an appetite for it.
You know, I've got that feeling in this building from both the Senate and the House that they're not wanting to bond anything and add to our state's debt at this time.
Thompson's counterpart in Senate Finance, Eagle River Republican Anna McKinnon, agrees.
We have zero ability to bond and help the Port of Anchorage. You know, as managing my own household budget, you don't want to take on debt when you're not sure of what your future income is going to be.
McKinnon plays a big role in putting out the capital budget, which could be another avenue for port funding. She doesn't believe it makes financial sense for the cash-strapped state to spend capital funds at a time when the municipality of Anchorage still has more than $100 million on hand. That money is from the past allocations and is earmarked for the new design. McKinnon denies that party politics is playing a role here. She shot down a funding request from Berkowitz's conservative predecessor, too.
I turned Mayor Sullivan down, and I've turned Mayor Berkowitz down, both for similar reasons. The state doesn't have extra money to contribute to a project that has sufficient funds to move through another year of development.
Even Democrats who generally support the port modernization say they can't get behind a funding request this session. Representative Les Guerra's district covers the port area.
You know, I'm also battling cuts to seniors, cuts to people with disabilities, cuts to the university, cuts that are harming our ability to keep people in the state of Alaska. They're going to start moving.
In the Senate, Anchorage Democrat Berta Gardner says funding port improvements simply can't be a priority for lawmakers this session.
In terms of whether it's likely to move forward, I'm not optimistic about that right now.
For his part, Berkowitz also doesn't expect funding to come through this year. However, he thinks this session has brought things closer to a long-term solution. But he insists that the port plays too valuable a role in the state's economy for hazards to be ignored.
The legislature right now is all consumed with what's going on in the Capitol building, and they're consumed with what's going on in the present. And thinking about what the future is going to look like and how to get to a better future is not currently part of the conversation. You cannot ignore future responsibilities just to satisfy present responsibilities, and they haven't found that balance yet.
For the time being, the port is spending $6 million to test its new design as part of a proof of concept for the modernization project. 10 steel pilings, each one 200 feet long, will be driven deep into the inlet mud. And that is why you might spot a 20-story tall crane, largest on the West Coast, in the port during the days ahead. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A man who was injured in a bear mauling near Haines early this week was attacked by a brown bear sow with at least one cub. That's according to Alaska Fish and Game biologist Stephanie Sell, who is tasked with gathering information about the incident. University of Alaska Assistant Professor Forrest Wagner was leading a five-day mountaineering trip on Mount Emmerich when he encountered the bear. Wagner was medevaced to Providence Hospital in Anchorage, where he is in serious condition. The nine students and two teaching assistants with him were not harmed. Sal says she will wait to talk to the students until they are ready. Much of her information now comes from a local wildlife trooper. Sal's goal is to figure out what happened to see what can be learned to try to prevent future attacks.
We just want to learn what happened. Was there anything that triggered it? You know, they were in a remote location, and it's really good denning habitat. So, you know, that kind of just adds to the factor that they were probably close to areas where sows would be with cubs. You know, I do suspect that it was just kind of a surprise event where, you know, Mr. Wagner was hiking up above the group and, you know, the bear surprised him and he surprised the bear.
Sal says as Wagner was being evacuated from the mountain, the students heard a cub bawling. The risk of the sow returning was partly why the whole group was evacuated by helicopter.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Healthcare in rural Alaska faces unique challenges. With few doctors and unpredictable weather, village clinics are often a community's only local option for care. That's the case in the St. Lawrence Island community of Savoonga. But as KNOM's Emily Russell reports, the clinic's highly certified health aides have earned recognition across the state.
Health aides Brianne Glogerin and Danielle Reynolds had been on the job for just 6 months when faced with their first emergency. Someone in Savoonga had been shot and needed a chest tube. Glogerin called a doctor in Nome. There was a chance the patient could be flown to Norton Sound Regional Hospital for emergency care. The first time she checked the weather, the skies were clear for flying.
I went to go check again, and it was like thick ice fog. And he said, well, you're going to have to do a chest tube. Okay. What's that?
Yeah, what's a chest tube?
What's a chest tube?
The two pulled it off. Between that emergency and a handful of others, Reynolds says she and Glogerin became a great team, something their fellow health aides appreciated.
And so they didn't mind that we were partners every single time we did something because they knew we worked well together.
Reynolds and Glogerin say they learned a lot those first few months. When they weren't on call or busy with patients, Glogerin says they practiced on each other.
Like TB skin tests.
A tuberculosis skin test involves an injection under the top layer of skin. Reynolds says the simple shot should not hurt.
I made her cry.
I was like, and I cried a couple of tears.
The two have supported each other through a lot of pain and long hours over the last 5 years. Glogerin says it started to weigh down on them this winter.
We were all getting that burnout feeling. Like, oh, I just wish I could get a different job where I could spend more time with my family.
I could go on a vacation.
Right.
For like a month.
Just a lot of little things that started building up. You know, we were feeling that. And then we got that email.
The email revealed that Savoonga's health aides were the recipients of this year's Distinguished Providers Award. The Healthy Alaska Natives Foundation sponsors the award. According to the foundation's website, Savoonga's health aides were selected for their resilience and strength in emergency situations, something both Glogerin and Reynolds have the scars to prove. Reporting in Savunga, I'm Emily Russell.
The building that houses the incinerator in Igigik burned down Tuesday night, just as the Bristol Bay fishing community started gearing up for the busy season. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more.
Igigik City Administrator Don Strand says he got a call that the 2,700-square-foot building was burning around 10 p.m.
Went out there. It appeared to be more or less totally engulfed on the inside. There was a fair amount of fire in the back of the building outside, pallets and whatnot burning. We got that put out first to try and keep the tundra fire from starting, which we did. Then proceeded to try and put out the inside of the building.
Strand says the community pitched in to fight the fire, including about a dozen newly arrived icicle employees who were there getting ready to open up the plant for herring season.
Went through the first 2,000 gallons of water, putting out the majority of the outside burning stuff, like say the pallets and stuff that were burning behind the building. And then the truck more or less ran out of water, so we brought it back and filled up, spent the next 2,000 gallons mopping up the outside and putting water on the inside.
The cause of the fire is unknown. Wednesday afternoon, Strand said the building was still smoldering, and the city doesn't know the exact extent of the damage just yet, as it can't go inside to inspect the two units that usually burn the community's garbage.
Looks like it's probably a total replacement. It's insured. The insurance company doesn't want anybody in there until they get an investigator out here either the end of this week or first part of next week. Still burning and smoking inside enough that don't want anybody in there until we are sure it's structurally sound. And it's still standing. I mean, it's a shell, but it's still standing.
Figuring out what needs to be replaced and possibly shipping something in could take some time. Right now, Strand says he's trying to figure out what to do with Igigik's garbage in the meantime.
We got a landfill that we normally take stuff, either non-burnable stuff or stuff we've already burnt out there. And we'll just have to kind of come up with some kind of plan to have it open certain times where we can dump the garbage and semi-bury it somehow. You know, we get enough wind here in the summertime all year round, actually. It's pretty unpredictable starting large open fires outside.
Strand says a replacement will probably cost about $1.5 million, but he won't know for sure until the insurance investigator can inspect the damage. The incinerator was installed in 1998 with additional capacity added 8 years ago. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Ann Hillman, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Laura Craigle in Nome, Emily Files in Haines, Emily Russell in Savunga, and Molly Dishner in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska's salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.